EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments.
All right, we're recording now, so I'll say words and stuff.
Words and stuff. All right.
And things.
And things and stuff. And so welcome back to another episode of EMS on the Mountain, though we are nowhere near a mountain now.
No, we're in a hotel room.
We are.
North Carolina.
Yes, we're attending the Fast 24, what is it, flight and surface or whatever, transport, something.
Are these just flatbread GDs?
Yeah, it's the Flight Bridge Critical Care Conference, and it's lovely.
And so far it hasn't sucked.
No, it's actually been pretty entertaining.
Yeah. Which, in case anybody hasn't noticed, when I say something doesn't suck, that means it's actually pretty good, because I think everything sucks.
He's not wrong.
Sean sucks most of the time.
Always. That's why I'm the world. Since Garancio stole, well, I guess he didn't steal, he beat us to world's okayest paramedic. I guess I'll be the world's most mediocre paramedic.
Yeah, you are by far the most mediocre paramedic I've ever met, Sean. All right. We're a little inspired, so to speak. It turns out getting edumacated makes us think about edumacation, and we wanted to talk a little bit about edumacation and our opinions on maintenance of edumacation and skill set and what you should do about that.
Yeah, this is a topic we discussed, I don't know, off and on for the last few months. It's one of the episodes we wanted to record, and then being down here at the conference, it kind of was like, oh, we should record about that, because we've seen some really good presentations today.
Yeah.
And they brought to the forefront a lot of, or reinforced, I guess I should say, a lot of our own personal opinions on education, continuing education, and
generally being educated.
Proficiency as a provider. And I think the bottom line is, if you're not continuing your education, then you're an ass. And why do you keep doing this work? And I think Mike would agree, as we've had this discussion, that the reason we come to things like Fast 20, for those of you who don't know, Mike and I are not critical care. We're not cool flight medics or anything like that.
No, we don't have patches or onesies or nothing.
We got some patches.
Oh yeah, we have patches. And we got some stickers.
We got stickers and we got all kinds of stuff. But at the end of the day, Mike and I have both found that, and I don't say this to sound like we're the shit, we're all that, and we're the greatest providers anybody's ever met.
You are pretty mediocre. But
I've been an ALS provider for a lot of years now, and when it comes to standard CE-type educational components and offerings that are out there, I like to think I'm beyond that now. Like, I don't need to keep hearing a lecture about, you know, the BVM, you know, killing people with the bag and everything. It's just, yeah, I know, I get that. You've got to have solid BVM skills and make a good seal and rate and volume and everything else. I want to learn more than just the same regurgitation of basic stuff that you all should have learned in EMT or paramedic or advanced EMT or whatever level you're providing at. If I was a physician, or if I have a physician, and I don't know if physicians have a CE kind of requirement. I know nurses do, but
pretty sure they do.
I don't want a doctor who just is comfortable staying at the same level of knowledge and education he had in like 1988 when he graduated in med school. I want a doctor that's progressed in learning and keeping up with the current science and literature and everything within his specialty, whether that's podiatry or emergency medicine. Like, I want the guy that's on top of the game and and is staying up ahead of stuff. I don't think, you know, I'm not going to be publishing a paper anytime soon about anything. I've got a couple of article ideas I've thought about submitting to some various publications. I don't know if I'll get around to it. I've written them.
He's generally pretty lazy.
Yeah.
Which is a key. It's a key aspect of a paramedic. Especially lazy, wants to know.
Especially when you're this mediocre paramedic. Mm-hmm. And so coming to conferences like this reinforced this is why I want to keep learning things. Because while not everything here is new to me, Mike and I have both taken a lot of critical care courses and training and reading and other education.
We should probably take a test one of these days.
We might even pass that thing. I don't know. Yeah, people have asked us, like, wait, you've been doing all this and you haven't taken that test? And I don't do that work, but I do. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I guess the whole gist of this podcast, and then I'll shut up and let Mike run his mouth for a minute, is don't be content as a provider at whatever level you're at with the same old everyday continuing education model that's out there and offered by most places. Look to up your game in whatever ways are available to you. And that might be increased education in just normal clinical things like cardiology, pulmonology, all that other stuff. Or it might be for you folks that target most of this podcast to, you wilderness guys, up in your game and your skill set to operate in these austere environments. Are you able to operate on rope like we've talked about a couple of episodes now? How proficient are you at going the down and the up? When's the last time you did a rappel with your kit? Have you ever done it with a full pack? Things like that, right?
Is this something I'm supposed to make a joke about? Have you ever intubated hanging from a rope on the side of a cliff with a woman that took a pitch? I haven't either.
Yeah, neither. But we really considered it.
Yeah, it was going to happen. Had the timing worked.
Yeah, actually, there was a helicopter that showed up overhead to prevent it.
Yeah, otherwise it was going to happen. So
with that, Mike, what are your thoughts on all this?
All right, I made some notes. First off, I just want to say, and I know he does everything under a public use, whatever. Scott Weingart, that dude, he is a smart dude. And what he's done for medicine and what he's pushed forward in the MCRIT podcast and the things he has promoted in that everyone should care more about the care they provide and they should always be striving to do more. That is so insanely applicable to the wilderness.
Yeah.
I have a note here. I made a bunch of notes, but I have a note here that let's start with wilderness providers in a true wilderness setting are not high touch. They're just not.
Mm.
And one of the cool things I did during Fest 24 is I attended the cadaver lab. Shout out to anybody that's listening that was in the cadaver lab with us.
Yeah, good time.
Guessing it's no one, but we only have 6 listeners. I met some folks that were really nice paramedics. They work in very high volume systems in conversation with the instructors. Questions like, how often have you intubated? When's the last time you had your intubation? I was with one person that was like, man, I dropped 4 tubes last week. And that's cool. But how many of those were done well? When's the last time you spent the time to think about your technique and your methodology and got the repetitions in without being under stress?
Mm.
And one of the agencies I provide for does require, actually 2 of them are about to require, because I'm going to push this, semi-annual skills refreshers. But how often as paramedics do we intubate when it's not Fred the Head? Are we intubating somebody that isn't a general emergency, right? And it occurred to me that if you aren't taking the time and the opportunity to attend as much external training and skills management as you can, it's pretty easy to become pretty complacent about how you do things. And complacency is kills. Like, that saying's been around forever. That cadaver lab, it was very useful to me. There was not a single skill we discussed in that cadaver lab. And again, this is a critical care focused program. So, you know, placement and suturing of chest tubes and such was on the docket. Now, I know how to place chest tubes. I've been taught previously, but it's not something I do in my practice. So even the chest, what I was heading for was even the chest tube part was not something that is foreign to me, but it was still all very useful education. It was still very useful to understand different points of view and different perspectives on how to do things, right? We did a bunch of IO work. We did a bunch of decompression work. I was exposed to some newer equipment on the market. I forget what that thing is called. Big old decompression needle with the scalpel on the end of it.
The spear.
I've heard of them. I'd never seen one before. Yeah. But I know how to decompress people. I even brought into question myself. Am I waiting too long? A lot of systems are nascent and I'm starting to rethink that, but I wouldn't have had the opportunity to think through, for example, my practice. And when I decided to pull the trigger on decompressing somebody, I wouldn't have been forced to think through my decision matrices beforehand if I hadn't taken the opportunity to attend this training. So what I'm saying is, it's not just about going and listening to people lecture at you. It's not about just maintaining CEs to maintain your state certification. If you want to be a good practitioner of medicine, and I'm going to argue that most folks in a wilderness environment need to be good practitioners of medicine, and we're going to talk about extended care here in a second, you have to go seek out additional education. It's a sign of a good provider in that they want to go get better. They want to be challenged. They want to hear things they haven't heard before, which sometimes I think it's lost in translation when we're working the, you know, working that 2448 or working that 2496 or whatever you work, 2490. And you're just turning and burning, running calls, doing the same thing you always did, dropping them off. And that's not to say that everybody listening to this podcast is spending 3 days at a time with a patient. Hell, we don't.
Not very seldom.
But it isn't uncommon for us to spend 6 to 12 hours.
Easy.
And so that kind of brings me to one of the first things that sort of became pretty obvious to me. Some of the conversations I've had here, even met a guy during a vent class that blew my socks off. Like, this guy's ability to regurgitate med math for pediatric patients, impressive, right? Most of us at the table are breaking out calculators, we're breaking our hands heavy, we're trying to make sure we get the math right. He's doing it like off the top of his head because it's rote memorization for him, right?
Yeah.
And just watching him, and again, this was not in a wilderness scenario per se, but watching him know his med math so well and being able to just regurgitate it made me think, holy crap, if I were in a situation, and I, keep in mind, it is not uncommon for between Sean and I to sling 400, 500, 600 micrograms of fentanyl in our contact.
Oh, yeah.
It's not uncommon to be slinging quite a bit of ketamine, right? Yeah. But how many of us think about the compounding effect? How many of us think about the good med math? How many of us think about, okay, if I'm going to be doing these boluses, but we're going to be hanging out for a while, maybe I need to. And there are providers that are listening to this right now. They're like, dude, I mix drips all the time. But do you mix drips and actually administer the entire drip, or do you mix the drip and then get in the truck and 20 minutes later, at the latest, you're at the hospital, and then they're tearing down your drips and they're mixing new drips, right? Are you managing your med math? Have you thought about, I've only got 4 vials of fentanyl with me, and I got to make this last. What can I do? What can I add to it? What can I mix in? Have I done all the BLS to position the patient properly? Am I managing temperature? Temperature is a huge one. We talk about that all the time, right? Medications are not going to work if you're not warm. Are you keeping your patients warm? Are you giving them cold fluid? That's not going to help. Not necessarily going to hurt, but in combination with a bunch of other factors, you should probably consider like doing what you can to administer warm fluid to a patient that you're managing for hours. There are some things related to what we do that we probably need to make sure we're better at, especially as wilderness providers. But I'm going to finish the thought.
Yeah.
It was really Scott Weingard's presentation this morning that made me think about it. I'm going to paraphrase this. I don't remember exactly how he said it. You got to come ready to do what the patient requires, not do what your protocols say.
Yeah.
Right. And in the wilderness environment, oftentimes we can't call medical control. And our protocols are, depending on what agency you work for, it might be written by a hospital system on the other side of the country for it, right? You got to be willing to come with the skill set and be comfortable doing that.
Yes. That's a very solid point. And I don't know how many, Mike and I, of the 50-some episodes, and probably half of those at least, we've talked about, I don't know, repeatedly, that as a wilderness and austere provider, your knowledge of your pathophysiology of your various injuries and illnesses, and your knowledge of your, of whatever collection of drugs it is that you have at your avail, whether that's a BLS provider and relying on a lot of OTCs, or you're a paramedic with a much more expanded, or you're like Mike and I, where you have, I would call it a minimalist paramedic set of drugs for us in our wilderness gig with 40 plus meds. And so you, as a provider, when you have these are the drugs we have, and don't get me wrong, I'd say for 90 plus percent of our cases, we have the right drugs. We have what we need.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we might not have enough for those extended contact things where analgesia is a thing. And I've only got a couple things of fentanyl and a couple things of morphine and a fairly robust vial of ketamine. But do we have enough? And then the big one is, okay, I have these drugs. This is what I need to do. What do I have that can get me to that endpoint or near it? And so you have to have that baseline of knowledge. And I think one of the biggest things, this is one of his opening comments, was one of their, or at least his older guiding mottos for his educational thing with MCRT and everything else was bringing the upstairs care downstairs. And basically he was talking about bringing ICU level care down to the ED, because he had seen his early practice that in his ED, wherever he started, that they'd get to point like D in an algorithm and okay, that's where we stop in the ED. It's up to somebody else now. And he was like, man, that's bullshit. These guys need more and they're not going to get upstairs probably in time for that to be relevant. We need to do that here. And they're like, we don't do that here. And I think that's very applicable to us in the wilderness and austere setting. That whole carry that upstairs to the downstairs thing really applies to, you need to be able to take EMS model of taking the ED to the ambulance to bring care out to the peoples pre-hospitally. And then being able to take that ambulance level care to your backpack and take it to people in those remote wilderness and austere environments is where we need to be. And you do have to work within that wilderness and austere context of limited supplies, because that is a thing, because you got to carry it on your back, right?
That's funny you mentioned that.
As happy and light as the Zoll X series monitor is, I'm still not stuffing that in my backpack.
No.
I would love to, but it's just not there yet. And there are devices that can do some of those functions that are available and small and compact, but they don't do all of the things, right? You would have to carry multiple components to get to the same level of stuff, which I'm not saying isn't feasible. It's just most agencies that practice wilderness and austere stuff don't have them for various reasons, whether it's a financial funding thing, like we simply can't afford that. I can either keep you in stock with your meds and your first aid supplies, or we can blow our entire year's budget and buy two of these devices. Well, the odds of us needing, really no kidding, needing a field 12 lead, depending on where you're at, is slim. I won't say it's never needed, and would I love to be able to do it? Yeah, certainly.
It's another input in the data construct, but
at the same time,
on whole for us, it would certainly be better than not.
Yes.
But we have developed other, we'll call them old school, pre-12 lead. Like, we've gone back to some of the OG and use a lot more of the touchy-feely.
Brilliance in the basics, as my special operations brethren would have called it, right? It's not so much that there's any super high-speed, badass new way to do paramedicine. You just need to be really good at all your foundational skills.
You just have more toys.
And I thought, yeah, just that whole mentality of being able to bring organized pre-hospital care out into the wilderness environment, which is the whole reason we had this podcast. It's why Mike and I like doing that work. The challenge of it, where, man, I can't just tell one of five providers on scene to, hey, go ahead and get me a 12 lead. You throw them on Capno while I take a listen to some lung sounds and send somebody else off with a laptop or an iPad to start gathering patient information and all their medical history and the current drugs they're on. I don't have an ambulance crew and an engine company rolling up on high acuity call. I have maybe initially, might be just me and Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And then on a super supported call, initially it might be one or two of us, like me or Mike, and maybe an EMT who is also nearby. That's about it. And that might be what you have for hours before other people are able to get mustered and brought to the scene to bring you, like, I need somebody else, another ALS provider, to either A, show up and bring me their drugs, or send them with somebody,
mm-hmm.
or get in the ambulance and get this yellow ALS bag that's labeled ALS medications and bring that to me. We've talked about before where Mike and I have told other people, say, hey, what do you guys need? And it's, hey, in the ambulance, there's going to be this red bag. Bring that to us. It contains like some additional ALS supplies, IV access, IO, and most importantly, it's a lot of our advanced airway intubation supplies. Because you might get that initial call and you're like, all right, this sounds pretty standard. Oh, shit. That was not a 2-foot fall. It was a 22-foot
fall. And that's 10 times more than expected.
And things changed very quickly. So your ability to manage that patient initially with BLS, airway adjuncts, and a BVM, you got to be on your game. Because again, it might just be you. But anyway,
very true.
That whole bit of word vomiting shifted thing. But
yeah, and we're not going to make this a super long podcast, but
will we?
I don't know.
We'll see where this goes.
Yeah. So there were a few other things. We've talked about some of this before, but this became pretty germane to me again. And shout out to the IBSC rep that's here. I challenged him a little bit on research and knowledge-based things, and he had pretty good answers. But prolonged care is not just doing the same thing for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to define prolonged care as more than 90 minutes with a patient. I'm using that metric because most people in a pre-hospital setting can be in an emergency room, like within the continental United States, like environments. They can be to a definitive facility, or they can be to a regional facility that can fly you out after getting all that magical telemagic. To quote somebody I met this week, there's a reason critical care paramedics exist on helicopters, because, you know, sometimes you got to fly people to a higher level of care. But I'm going to use the metric of give or take 90 minutes, right? A long transport for me in one of my ground jobs, 60 minutes, 60, 70 minutes. But as a paramedic, I will generally manage that STEMI or that medical emergency the same way for that drive from wherever I was to the emergency room. Once you get beyond about an hour and a half, right? If you think about general, I'll use the term, quote unquote, standard paramedic level knowledge. How many people have protocols to keep nebbing somebody until they're not? How many ambulances have enough ANA to just keep that rolling for 90 minutes? I'd argue a fair share do not. I'm sure there's some. 90 minutes is a window where you start going, huh, this is the point where I'm going to be with you a little bit longer.
And I think a good point in that is even on an ambulance, I work in my urban system is, I would say, very good. We have a pretty, I would call it a very average pharmacological suite. And even if I had somebody for an hour and a half or 2 hours, there are some drugs that I might start to run thin on simply because it's not designed around the extended care timeline, right? It's predicated on showing up on scene, doing your initial assessment, maybe some initial stabilization. Couple of items. If you need to get that 12 lead done, or if you think it's best to get that IV access before you start driving, then boom, then you're off and on the road. And I can be to my normal community hospital within 15 minutes, pretty easy from just about anywhere in my do. And then I can be to our local trauma center. Worst case scenario, and I'm talking bad weather traffic thing, probably 40 minutes. Normally it's 30 minutes or less, easily under 30. If we're running lights and sirens, the highway's clear, I can be there in 20 minutes, no problem. So I would agree with you on that 90-minute piece, because there are some very rural communities where the volunteer crew picks you up at your house and they might have that hour-plus transport.
Right.
So it's not to say that certainly doesn't happen. There are definitely some rural communities where you're not near a hospital and it might take a while. But I think that 90-minute mark is probably a pretty good metric for general thought and where you need to really start thinking long game.
That's where I was going with this. If the 90-minute mark is the threshold we're going to use for this, that's really the mark where I would almost call it a subset of nursing care starts to come into play.
Certainly.
Right? So there's a running joke at EMS, or as long as I've been doing it for, I don't know, damn long time, no longer. Paramedics don't deal with poop.
I've dealt with some poop recently.
But in general, we're not cleaning.
Yeah.
We're not doing maintenance of expulsion.
Yeah, you're doing it. Right? A quick wipe down before you bag them up, but get them on your cot and whatever you need. But
at 90 minutes, that starts to become a factor.
It does.
Right. Yeah. It does. Like just take a stump simple aspect, right? Screw patient comfort, which is absolutely something we should care about. But let's just throw that out the window for the purpose of discussion. whether it's fecal matter or urine, 20 to 40, 50 minute transport, like I can just leave him in there and largely make it a hospital problem. In the woods, in wet clothing, that's now a thermoregulation problem, right? Yeah. I can't leave them in the poo. I cannot leave the PP on them because all of us that are relatively intelligent providers understand that any ambient temperature below 98 degrees has the potential to produce some sort of hypothermic response in a patient, right?
Especially people that are injured and ill. That's strange.
And the fluid we've put in them and the all of the other things we've done.
Well,
so 90 minutes is now my new sort of window after hearing some stuff today that says, and part of this comes from talking to guys that have multi-hour flights.
Yeah, yeah.
And I started thinking, like, I don't have to be in a helicopter to have to start caring about extended care aspects of paramedicine. And I think this statement might be completely incorrect, but based on my knowledge of folks I've taught and schools I've worked at, education I've provided, there's a lot of providers that don't necessarily, let me rephrase it this way. You don't get taught in paramedic school that a lot of the interventions we perform as paramedics are just initial interventional things that may be long-term not the best for the patient, but we do it in the short term because it's an emergent situation. And then the hospital handles the secondary and third level effects of the things we do, right? Certain medications we push, certain things we do, the gold standard that nobody really talks about, right? If you meet a four-year paramedic, hats off to the EMS 2020 guys. But if you meet a four-year paramedic and they're like, oh man, yeah, we got like hypertonic saline for a patient, right? How many paramedics really understand that what you're basically doing is trying to kill them?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of work to reverse that effort in the hospital after they've been given the hypertonic saline, right? You're basically dehydrating the shit out of them.
Yeah. And I liken that too, because I get, as a current training guy for one of my agencies, right? We're covering some of our most common medical emergencies. And of course, the diabetic issues come up quite often because we see those a lot. And I'm talking about my urban side. And of course, everybody's, why don't we carry like insulin? And it's, listen, there are some flight and ground critical care programs that do, but that's not one of those drugs that you just like, oh yeah, here, let me just sling you a couple of units and see where we go from there, right? That's one of those things that if you do the wrong thing with that, can cause just a whole cascade of problems for people metabolically. And so that's why it's like, you don't see that on just a normal ground transport 911. Oh, if their sugar's so high, why don't we just give them insulin? There's a number of reasons
there's a number of reasons, right?
So yeah, you got to start titrating things correctly because fluid shift and all this other stuff we're not going to get into it, but right.
Science.
Those of you that know, understand what we're talking about. And if you don't know, up that education game, guys.
Yeah, that's really what we're angling at in this podcast is if you're going to be doing extended care, you have to understand the extended implications of the thing.
And so, yeah, like the hypertonic saline is a great one. Oh, yeah, or even mannitol and stuff. And I think you hit the nail on the head. Like paramedics, we are, and don't get me wrong, I truly 100% believe in the work paramedics do in the pre-hospital environment.
Mm-hmm.
EMTs as well. Don't let me just assume just ALS. Yeah, do you need a paramedic on every call? Absolutely not. Can good, solid EMTs take care of a vast majority of somebody's problems, why they call 911 for the most part. If you look at the numbers, yeah, no worries. But it's those few people that have an issue that a paramedic can get involved that is actually a good thing. We did get another talk today about should paramedics be trying to fix AFib with RVR?
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, the study cited and his own knowledge and clinical background said, yes, absolutely 100%, because there's actually a reduction in mortality. There's a reduction in ED stays, reduction in ICU admits, everything else. Because a lot of places are like, if they're still got a heart that's beaten, they're perfusing and they're alive, just drive them here. You don't need to worry about that. And I chuckle when he started to bring that up because I've had a lot of AFib RVR cases over the last like month and a half. And I've slung a lot because we use metoprolol.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have diltiazem as well, and then for whatever reason that fell out of our formulary.
Do you have coolers? I forget.
We used to have little fridges in the units, and that might be wise because of the climate control problem with it. So I've been given a lot of metoprolol for AFib with RVR, and I've had very good results with it. I haven't had any issues with it. And I've had a couple of patients who, by the time we get them to the hospital, oh God, I feel so much better. Whatever you did, that was awesome. And I'm like, cool, I did paramedicine today. with that, there are certain things, even people and everybody, I don't want people to think I'm getting on this bandwagon that the evil of normal saline, the pasta water, the battery acid, like if you've got that in your mindset, you're an ass and educate yourself, right? Is pumping your patient full of 6 liters of normal saline without cause good for them? No, but
no.
Who in their right mind is still
giving epi without cause doing is that, not good for them either.
Right.
Right.
But so where this was leading me with your example of the hypertonic is even just normal saline for somebody who's excessively dehydrated, who you're suspecting might be hyponatremic, right? Oh, you're low on your sodium. I've got salt water right here. And sodium is one of those drugs that you do not correct quickly.
No, it's also not the right salt water.
Right. But you're saying it's not quite the right stuff either.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those, you might be hyponatremic. I've got salt water here. Let me give you a liter of fluid. And I'm not saying it's going to kill your patient.
Just to be clear, you're not diagnosing hyponatremia in the field, not without a lot of tools we probably don't have.
Yeah, they're called labs. And I don't get to test serum sodium in the field.
And I don't taste beef.
Yeah, it always tastes bad. At least in my experience. So yeah, there's something that you would think is benign as normal saline. Oh, I'm just going to give like a 500 ml bolus, or maybe I'll just pump them a liter and see how they're doing. That actually, if you don't do a little history gathering on them, might turn out to be not a great thing, right? A 500 ml bolus, probably pretty benign. Even if they're pretty severely hyponatremic, that level's not going to be an issue. You start hitting a couple liters that...
But what about ringers, Sean?
I love lactate.
I'm teasing. Totally teasing.
The other obvious one is epi, right?
Yeah.
I've actually run into this in wound care. What often doesn't get taught in paramedic school. Again, don't listen to the preamble, right? Follow your local protocols, even though I'm starting to hate that phrase because I'm advocating for people to have knowledge, not just do what the doctor says. But what do we do for... here's a pretty common thing you might experience in a wellness environment, right? Allergic reaction. Somebody gets a bee sting. Somebody has a reaction to something found in nature they didn't know they were going to have a reaction to, but now it's going to take 4 hours to get them to the hospital. How many times are you going to give them epi?
Is this necessary?
As many times as necessary at the end of the day, right? You're going to be calling for orders if you can, but most people do not understand that epinephrine does have effects on the metabolic functions. It can actually cause lactic acid problems. It can, and knowing whether it's going to be them or not, I think it also, if I recall correctly, be also... impacts the blood glucose, doesn't it? And if you're diabetic and you're having an allergic reaction and you get multiple swaps of epi, I'd have to go research that one. I'll have to look it up.
Yes, I can't remember off the top of my head either, but it might be just related to you're increasing.
Yeah, you could just be the heart rate.
So you're just kind of increasing the metabolic processes.
But my point here was like one or two doses of epi, probably not the end of the world. 5 or 6? Could be causing other problems. You need, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't do it. I'm saying you need to be aware that prolonged care, being with somebody for more than 90 minutes, you have to think through the problem more holistically.
And that brings me up to another one of Weingart's bits of brilliance that Mike and I immediately recognized as one of the foundational pieces of wilderness and austere care, is he talked about logistics, right? The military phrase of amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics, right? Yeah. And that traces its way all the way back to the Napoleonic Wars. One of Napoleon's quotes is an army marches on its belly, right? You can have all the ammo and all the training, but if your troops are starving and dying of thirst by the time they get there, they're not going to be super effective in combat. So logistics is the piece, and man, where is that more appropriate medicine than the wilderness and austere environments, right? Where you only have so much room in a pack. You might only have so much help that can help you carry more stuff, right? Mike's talked about before in a previous episode of schlepping several D cylinders in his backpack. And
that sucked.
Right? Yeah. And that's, holy cow, man. If your patient really needs oxygen that bad and you don't have an option to fly them out or something that's much more expeditious.
Sounds like you need a logistics train of people hiking.
You got to try and do what you can do. But at the end of the day, like, man, if they're not need, if they're needing more than like a 4 liters per minute nasal cannula piece, I know where Mike and I are at. You're not going to get enough D cylinders to last for a 6 hour.
I'm going to try though.
Carry out,
but they're not getting 15 liters per minute. And as much as I can give them,
so
and that's where it's funny. Shout out to Eric Bauer, who
ton of respect.
Mike's now a fanboy.
No, he often talks about, in critical care classes he teaches, he often talks about a good, this is in the context of the flight provider, but a good flight provider understands the math of how much oxygen they have and the size of their tanks and understanding the usage, I think it's called the usage coefficient. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look. But multiplying your tank by the number and leaving a 200 ml reserve to make sure that you have enough oxygen. But when you start looking at things, this is not necessarily wilderness specific, but if you start looking at things like high flu oxygen delivery from like a Hamilton T1 ventilator, you have to be able to do that math. The same principles apply when you're doing 4 to 6 liters per minute on a cannula trying to keep Meemaw at 89 to 90% oxygenation for the next 6 hours while you carry her out of the woods, because you're going to need to be able to do the math on the tanks, which I absolutely cannot do right this second, but I will figure out how to do very quickly.
There's an app for that, and that's what I use.
That's me too.
I'm not going to even pretend to. I learned how to do that math the hard way.
And then I took a test, and I never did it again.
And then there's an app for that, and I will, because it doesn't require internet connection, as long as my phone works. And there are some general guidelines that are out there and a couple of pocket guides. Like Mike and I both have some various note cards and pocket guides we also have in some of our kits. Then you have a general understanding of, okay, a D cylinder that's full at this PSI should last approximately this long on 4 liters and 15 liters. And so you can have some general guidance parameters. But the logistics piece, and this also, don't just think equipment. Your logistics in the wilderness and austere environment also needs to apply to the people coming to support you and the whole evacuation, extraction, or extrication like piece, like people to schlep ropes, litters, additional medical supplies.
And skill sets to go with it.
A sleeping bag to put my patient in when they get there, because the small fleece blanket, Mylar space blanket, and sleeping pad I have are good temporizing measures, because that's what I can carry in my backpack. Sure, could I carry a full-size sleeping bag? I'm not going to, because I'm going to run out of space eventually, and I just can't schlep it all myself, no matter how much I want to. And so you got to start thinking of that long-term thing. Like, people are caught off guard when Mike and I roll up on one of these more severe wilderness cases that we've been fortunate enough to be at almost every one of them.
Yes. That was sarcasm.
And then the first thing we do is, like, we get that initial patient thing, like, okay, what do we got? This is what happened. This is their current condition. Okay. And then it's best if he and I are both there, because then we can do that whole, I don't know, dude, what do you think? I think we need to call for a hoist. Mm-hmm. Or is this stable enough that we can do the traditional, if we had to do the whole rope technical rescue piece, could we do the raise or lower and then the walk to wherever? And the answer to that might be yes.
Or if we're managing the patient, who's going to do that for?
And then the next piece comes at, I need to get another adult here where I can go, hey, Jimbo, I need you to now be in charge of the rest of this. We've talked about this, I think, before when we were doing our little series on like mission planning and some stuff, like having your rescue coordinator, I forget what we called him. Once you've got the patient, you're the only one there. It's like being the first unit on scene at like an MCI. Like, you got to start triaging everybody. And then
you do scene safe PSI.
Right.
I have 37 patients. I'm going to need a lot of help.
Yeah. I'm
Send
on
me
scene.
Bob.
I have command, and then that's the last thing I ever want to have to put out over the radio.
Yeah, I don't
like,
ever do it.
As the first people on scene, like, I need an adult. Find me somebody else. Like, I don't want to have command.
I
want
to go do this so I can go medicine.
Yeah, it's like, I want to go do patient care, because I'm a paramedic. That's what I do. And so, yeah, you get somebody else on scene. And again, they have to also be educated, knowledgeable enough, and experienced enough to know what you need, or are able to listen to what you tell them and then execute. Right? Because you don't have a lot of, like, hey, listen, we talked about the double hoist we did several years ago now, where initially my patient was going to be grand transport. They're like, some little guy comes running up to me for the incident commander. Hey, what do you need? And it's like, okay, this is current state. This is what I need. I wanted ALS ground transport, and let's get on that. And it was like, okay, got it. Guy runs away, and I'm packaging for a ground transport. And then I get plans have changed. And it's, okay, cool. That's better. So changes happen, but somebody has to be thinking about that. And that's all part of that logistics piece, right? Patient care piece, the skills, the drugs, all of that is fantastic. And depending on your patient, may 100% be necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter how good you are as a paramedic, whether you're a critical care flight medic, flight nurse, doctor, whatever.
TPC, CCPC, FPC,
You've got all the cool
PQRST,
all the
CPT,
patches.
Yeah, man.
Your post nominals are
amazing.
Are longer than
you've got an MBA,
a European Duke, right? Like, cool. But if you can't get your patient out of the bad place, and I don't care if this is an urban setting or deep in the woods, if you can't get them to the hospital to that definitive care for surgical interventions or advanced airway management, like whatever it is, doesn't matter. They're gonna die.
Mm-hmm.
So the logistics piece really is the most important. Like, you have to do those paramedic, those temporizing stabilization methods, doing as much resuscitation as you can as appropriate. But if you don't have, and I'll just keep using that, the logistics wherewithal, that long game of, okay, I got them here. This is what I got to do to stabilize them, at least initially. And then because you're going to be with them for a while, then you start, okay, we've hit this point. I can take a breath. Now, what do I have to keep doing for that prolonged care piece? But you got to start thinking of that logistics piece of, what do I need? How are we going to get them out? What's the most efficient way going to be? If it were up to Mike and I, just for the sake of ease, and sometimes it's fun, we would hoist everybody out, right? Have the helicopter fly up, drop the line in a basket, toss them in it, hoist it up, have them flying off to a hospital. Boom, done.
Done. And then I just hike out.
Pick up my trash, pack my bag, walk on out, high five. We're heroes in the parking lot. Maybe get some hero shots.
Don't forget to IG that stuff.
Yeah, put that up on the gram.
On the gram, yeah.
Whatever the kids are doing these days. But that isn't always the case, right? So you have to have those backup things. Okay, weather looks good here, but where the helicopters we utilize, whether it's a traditional HEMS crew or another government entity that's going to come in, their weather might be horrible, or they might have sunshine and puppy dogs all over the place, and we're just in this like monsoon downpour. Ain't nobody flying. Then later on, you can hear, oh no, we could have got there. It was beautiful for us. We could have sat down right here and you could have brought them to us. And we're like, oh crap. Right?
Would have been good to think through before.
I wish I would have known that. So the logistics piece, I think, is often overlooked, especially for the new providers who are just getting into the wilderness austere piece. Like, you might come with a good background in EMS. You've been working 911 for a while. You've got some good experience. You've seen a good range of patients. You're pretty comfortable in your skill set and your knowledge. And you're like, hey, I found this opportunity. And this sounds like really cool. And then it's like, all right, so when does the whatever get here? I don't know if you asked for that yet. Oh shit, that's on me. Yeah, it pretty much is, until you have another adult shows up that can take over that responsibility for you. So that logistics piece, really, and again, that goes into, do you need oxygen? How much? How long is that going to last? If I'm going to do an advanced airway, I paralyze them. Now I sedate them. Can I maintain that sedation for the duration of the contact?
Man, I hope so.
That's a long, hard one right there, right? That's, you're looking at your formulary going, oof, I got this much ketamine and I got this much Versed with me.
Just crack them.
I can get this far.
That was sarcasm. Anybody that's listening that thinks you should just crack them, do not just crack them. Follow your local protocols. That was sarcasm.
Yeah. Crack them.
Just crack.
Anyway, that was a discussion some of us had at the cadaver lab when we were doing our intubation advanced airway stuff, was talking about, anyway, that's a whole nother episode. I think we talked about it enough.
Whole nother topic.
But so logistics is not just also the foot movement, ground movement, and like oxygen and equipment, man. You got to start thinking everything that's outside of immediate patient care. I lump into that logistics piece, like additional medical supplies. Do I need just more bandages? Like, I came up with a SAM splint. Do I need three? Because they got all kinds of broken bones. Who else has got one?
Yeah. Everyone should have one.
And everybody should have at least one. If you're an EMS or wellness first aider and you don't have a SAM splint in your kit or reasonable facsimile, shame on. Don't be that I'm going to use sticks guy, because fuck you.
Because there's no such thing as wilderness medicine. There's just medicine in the wilderness.
Fuck yeah. We're going to make that a bumper sticker.
Yeah, we are. All right. That was about everything I had in my notes. Is there anything else you wanted to mention, Sean?
One more piece. And I don't know. I don't know how long we've been going now, but I guess let's just bring it around full circle, talking about, this is an educational piece. And being at this conference reminded us of a lot of things that I think Mike and I take for granted sometimes in our practice, because we've been at this for a while. We're fairly experienced in this.
I'll fully admit that, like, it wasn't this conference, but it was mentioned to me recently when I lamented to someone that I did not understand why we were still having all these conversations about resuscitative sequence intubation,
oh, yeah,
or DSI versus RSI. And somebody reminded me quite correctly that I stay up on my shit and I understand the signs of what's going on. And there are a lot of providers that were taught how to tube someone and given RSI drugs 15 years ago and have not really kept up on them. And it turns out that resuscitation before you intubate someone is a life-saving skill. And there's still a lot of people that are not doing that. It was a good reminder to me to bring it full circle that you have to constantly challenge your opinions. You have to assume what you learned last year or the year before or 15 years ago in paramedic school. Frickin' wrong, right? I've been doing this long enough to rattle off the graveyard of good EMS ideas that have gone by the wayside, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Mass pants and give them all the fluids when they're bleeding and turn their blood into Kool-Aid and all of these things, right? You should assume that everything you were taught in the last 24 months is questionable and you need to go out and get the knowledge, right? Yeah. Do not assume what you learned last year applies this year. And the science is only accelerating, right?
Yeah.
Who was it? I think it's okay. It's paramedic podcast a few episodes ago. He was talking to somebody and he was like, yeah, do you think it's getting better? And they were like, oh, hell yeah. Like the amount of knowledge that is being transferred in social media, the amount of information available is totally different than it was even 5 years ago, much less 15 years ago. And I still work with paramedics that probably haven't had any additional education on how to do stuff for 15 years. It is your job to be a good practitioner of medicine. It is not your job to do whatever the hell you were told to do 15 years ago. And you say, oh, I didn't know any better, Bob.
No, and that's a perfect thing, right? And I guess this will be my last rant.
That applies to EMTs as well.
This applies to anybody in medicine, whether you're an EMT, paramedic, AAs, nurses, RTs, doctors, like if you're in medicine, and you're still relying on your initial education level of education and knowledge, again, fuck you. There's a reason we have an explicit warning, so there you go. And I know some providers that are like that. A very famous one still presents at conferences and stuff. Mm-hmm. That when you listen to this individual talk, you start going, are you aware that what you're saying is wrong? And not just a little wrong, but has been completely refuted by many, not just one physician's interpretation or something, but several studies and papers. And so, dude, you need to catch up. You are now irrelevant. And I know several providers personally who were probably extremely good, at least I like to think so, good paramedics. And then they just did normal CEs every year or however their research cycle is every 2 years. And they just went to the same airway management class and talked about, remember when you intubate, have your stuff ready. And they don't even talk about the pre-oxygenation, resuscitation, and everything else piece. Because not every existing CE program does that because it's, and a lot of that, I guess, is truly a jurisdictional fault because not everybody's up on the stuff.
Right.
And I think that's one of the big things. Like, we keep hearing about this, when dumping all this fluid into your patients. And every time I hear it, I'm like, where do you assholes run? Who is still doing this? Like, I can think of only two instances where your two large bore IVs wide open would even remotely apply. And that's generally speaking, severe burn patients and the septics.
Yep.
Other than that, and even then, me as a paramedic, I'm going to get you a heavy start on your fluids and I'm going to get you to the ED and let that physician titrate that up or down where they believe it needs to go based on current guidelines. Because I might not be up on my current sepsis guidelines on how much fluid they should get with me in that 20 minutes I got them.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, if they get more than a bag from me in 20 minutes, I had to have been pressure infusing like a champ.
They'll get two from me, but that's what my protocol is. Yep. Get two bags in them as quickly
yeah,
as possible.
Yeah, we got so the life flows. I mean, we do too, but that's really related to our blood administration piece.
Sure.
And that's because
follow your local protocols, boys and girls.
There you go, right? And for all I know, my protocols say I should give them a bunch of fluid, but I know it's like one of those get IV access, start flowing fluids. And if we could have broad spectrum antibiotics, like that'd be great. Here you go.
That's another great one for, hey, you should get that on board sooner than later for a number of things most people don't think about.
And that's one of the, and like in the wellness setting for Mike and I, for our wellness gig, we have antibiotics. It's supposed to be for that open fracture kind of thing. I don't know that I would necessarily, but you have that somebody out in the woods, somebody goes out and it's, oh yeah, look at this crazy rash, something, infection. Okay, you got this crazy
fever.
That would
be situationally dependent.
I might definitely call a physician on that one before I deviate that far from protocol. It's like talking to the doc, like, here's what I got. I do have this available. You want me to start this as well? And get the doc to go, yeah, that's a good call. Start that. I'm like, I'm on it. That's probably not one I'm going to do independently. And again, most of those people, I'm probably not going to see them backcountry wise. At least not in the traditional, well, not, I won't say traditional, but in the common setting Mike and I deal with. If it was more expedition support where that could have developed over the course of a couple of weeks or something, then yeah, that's a whole different ballgame. So those of you that are working those kind of things or other remote, you're working Everest Base Camp and somebody you think is septic, you got physicians there. If you think that's appropriate, yeah, absolutely. So anyways, I guess my last closeout, don't settle for your standard CEs. You have to increase your knowledge base. I don't care if it's stuff you'll never use. Like, I have a number of physician-level books on pathophysiology, cardiology, et cetera. I read those through, and I get up to the points where, yep, now that's way over my understanding. And I quit reading at that point. And then I'll put them down, take some more courses, do some more stuff. And next time I read through it, I might understand a little bit more, and I can go a little bit deeper into that, and I get a better understanding. But never settle for just your standard continuing education model. If you're not trying to up your game, and I'm not saying everybody needs to come to critical care conferences or take critical care training, but if you're a paramedic, and you're just a normal street 911 medic without all the cool post-nominals, and you aren't trying to advance your knowledge by taking an online critical care course, just, you might know a lot of that. And if you do, good on you, you're ahead of the game.
Between you and I, some of these, but I think we've done 8 or 9 courses. I've done 3. I think you've done 4 or 5.
I think and there's not many providers left out there. And why do I keep taking them, guys? Because they
provide the knowledge in a little bit.
Yes.
Maybe that's the way you can understand.
Because that's the thing is, and I look at it as, yeah, it's okay. It is money. It's a money, but I look at it as an investment in knowledge because I know I'm on my, like I said, like I've taken like 4 of these now over the last several years. It's not like I took them all in the last 12 months. But I learn a little bit something like the way, like we're at Fast 24. So I've taken the flight bridge program, right? Holy crap. Like Eric Bauer and his team, those people have, and I've met most of them in person being at this conference, and they are as stupid smart in person or smarter than they seem on the video lecture series, right? Those folks know this material. And it's really good to be able to ask them some follow-on questions that you might not always get to do in some of the online stuff. But I've taken their course and some others, and the way they taught some things, and they admit that they go into a bit more detail than is what would be necessary if you're going to be taking that test, which, cool, that's why I'm taking your stuff anyways. Like, I'm getting into some like ICU level nursing stuff, but it's fascinating, and it gives me a better understanding of maybe why certain medications would be better because of the pathophysiology and the pharmacokinetics and dynamics and all that other stuff. And like, that makes more sense now. Like when Mike and I did that, an extended provider course, and we got that cardiology lecture, like that dude, like so many things started clicking into place. Well, yeah, that dude's one of those cardiac wizards. Just because that we've all met those paramedics that are like, cardiology becomes their jam. Mm-hmm. That dude, it was like balls, bro. That was still one of the best cardiology lectures I've had.
And we did it in a garage.
We did it in a garage, right? With a dude on a dry erase board.
Yeah, with a folding table.
Yeah.
And a couple of folding chairs.
Yeah, and it was phenomenal.
It was amazing.
Mike will tell you, like, he thinks I'm a sociopath because when I drive, like, on my normal commute, I don't listen to the radio or anything. And if I listen to something, it's podcasts. And the only podcasts I listen to are medical related podcasts. And people are like, dude, you're a freaking nerd. Hey, did you hear the latest Rogan podcast? I'm like, no, never heard a single one, right? I've seen snippets of various episodes when he's interviewing somebody of interest for me, like my Lord and Savior, Pavel. For those of you that get that.
Strong first for the win.
Oh, you gave it away.
I'm a giver. I put out.
And so, I mean, I'll listen to somebody else's podcast, and it might be a podcast from a group of people in the UK, and whatever they're talking about might not
apply to which one you're talking about.
Yeah, it's, and those of you interested, it's the Recess Room.
The Recess Room.
Right. And they talk about they have their papers of the week or whatever, or their month, and they talk about recent research in emergency medicine or some other trends coming around. And so they're obviously focused on the UK. Mm-hmm. And
turns out humans work the same way pretty much everywhere in the world.
And that's what I'm saying is, okay, I can't independently implement this latest study's findings into my private practice because I still have to operate under my OMD and my protocols. But knowing the knowledge of some of the why this might be a thing that's changing.
Here, you want an example? I'll give you an example.
It's like amazing.
I recently provided a system to intervene on somebody in status epilepticus for an agency I run for.
Yes.
Because I was up to speed on the latest science on ketamine for breaking seizures.
That's a great example.
And this individual was, my understanding is, a known epileptic. He went into a wilderness environment that was atypical for them. Something got imbalanced between their medication and their oral intakes, and they ended up in status. And the providers there were hard time with slinging benzos trying to manage the seizure. Able to get a hold of some folks, and I said, listen, we need to get a hold of a doc. You need to have permission to give ketamine. I believe the dosing should be, let's confirm this with the doctor. But if I hadn't stayed up on my science, not many agencies are slinging ketamine for seizure with standing orders, right?
Yeah.
But the doctor understood what I was saying. They understood that we'd gone through the normal pathway. It worked.
Yeah, that's a great one. That's a really good one, right? Yeah, I guess I really don't have much to say that just challenge it, man. Don't settle for fucking your base level shit. Up your game.
All right. We're at about an hour. So I'm gonna break and say, I'm going to do a follow-up now. This is something new. Just decided to do it while we were talking. I got a message from a guy named Mike R. about the previous podcast. And I thought, what better way to provide the information than not only am I going to reply to his email, but other people might have had the same question. So I'm going to read the question to you. As one of the, quote, four listeners to the last pod. That's right. Four of you have listened. I like it, Mike. I like where your head's at. And a tech rescue kind of guy, I noticed that progress capture devices were not mentioned. Was this more because y'all consider them crew vice personal gear? Right there, I can tell you he's Southern. Our group uses Prusik for progress capture.
Ooh.
We've looked at other solutions. Hard to beat the cost of a Prusik. Y'all use something different. So here's the answer to this, Mike. First off, the podcast was focused on personal equipment.
Things found on your harness.
So under that context, I would argue that handle descenders are a much better tool for progress on rope for personal movement. But I think what you're asking me is progress capture in a haul system.
Yeah.
In a haul system, Prusik have long been the gold standard. There are a lot of devices on the market now from Petzl, from CMC, from another company I can't think of at the moment.
Harkin.
Oh, yeah. Harkin's got the thing.
Yeah, anyway.
But I will follow up to the email with more details. But there are a number of devices on the market. The thing you have to keep in mind, and this is deviating from personal equipment conversation into haul system and group gear conversation. I'm not a huge advocate of people using CMC clutches as a personal descender device. That's not their intended purpose, and it's way too heavy and big for what you need to do. But that said, there's a lot of great progress capture devices on the market that eliminate the need to use Prusik. Have to make darn sure the devices you are using are rated for rescue loads. There are a lot of folks that think you can throw a, I've seen this, you can throw a Petzl rig or a Petzl ID into a haul system and they're not actually rated for the load. There's ways to rig it. Like we're getting into some pretty advanced mathematical T-factor calculation-y stuff that I'm not going to go over right now on the podcast. But there are ways to rig systems to use an ID. But an ID is not foundationally meant to be a progress capture and redirection device in a haul system. Petzl makes other things. I think it's called Maestro. It is rated for that purpose. So there's the answer to your question, Mike. I appreciate you sending us a note. I will follow up in email as well and get you some more details. But thank you for sending the question. I hope that answers it. And if not, I hope my email does. And with that, stop.
Word.
If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of Wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, thanks for joining us. And until we see you on the mountain, train hard, be safe, and do good work.